You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 5th, Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Colorado, can state dodge recession again? CU forecast for next year predicts a slower economy, but one that continues to add jobs. By Aldo Svaldi. Purdue Pharma at U.S. Supreme Court. Justices seem split over opioid settlement. By Abby Van Sickle. War with Hamas. Israel attacks southern Gaza. More evacuations are ordered, but Palestinians run out of places to go. By Najib Jobain, Sami Magdi, and Jack Jeffrey. Letter to Congress. White House warns aid for Ukraine is running out. By Karun Demirjian and Laura Jakes. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Colorado. Can state dodge recession again? CU forecast for next year predicts a slower economy, but one that continues to add jobs. By Aldo Svaldi, The Denver Post. Colorado's economy next year won't be a bed of roses. With job gains running at their slowest pace since 2011 and commercial real estate under extreme stress. But neither will it be a bed of thorns as inflation eases and a recession doesn't set in, according to the 2024 Colorado Business Economic Outlook. It is a slower growth story. There are positive nuggets in there. We aren't forecasting a recession, and we expect a continued abundance of job opportunities for people, said Brian Lewandowski, Executive Director of the Business Research Division at the University of Colorado Boulder Leeds School of Business, which puts the outlook together each year. The outlook, based on input from 130 individuals across a variety of industries, as well as a sophisticated computer model, forecasts employers in the state will add 42,000 non-farm jobs. The state's unemployment rate will average 3.4%, not far off the 3.3% rate reached in October. Adding 42,000 jobs translates into a job growth rate of 1.4%, below the 2.2% growth rate estimated for this year. Initial unemployment reports through October put Colorado at a 1.1% annual pace, so reaching the expected rate will depend on some big revisions. We went from being roughly a top 10 state to being a bottom 10 state for job growth. How could we be so wrong, and do we need to revise our employment numbers? Lewandowski said of the questions the Outlook panel asked as it tried to prepare its 2024 forecast. The team essentially did the equivalent of throwing a red flag in football and challenged the initial statistics, which are based on employer surveys and later adjusted based on the actual headcounts reported in quarterly unemployment insurance premium reports. Other indicators were showing a much stronger economy than what the job numbers were suggesting. And helping with that decision, Ryan Gedney, a senior labor economist at the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment, has consistently argued employment growth this year will end up much stronger than initially reported. Revisions for the first two quarters so far are backing up his view. That said, layoff announcements have been rising in Colorado as the year comes to an end. Dish Network, which has been expanding rapidly to build out a new national cellular network, last month announced it would let go of 499 workers in Littleton and Englewood. Broadcom announced it would cut about 2,800 jobs at VMware following an acquisition of the company. That includes 184 workers in Broomfield, according to a letter filed on November 27th with the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. VF Corp., a sportswear and footwear maker behind several top brands, said at the start of the month it would let go 500 employees, including just under three dozen at the company's headquarters in Denver. Some of the strongest hiring this year has come at local governments and at hotels and restaurants, which aren't the highest paying places in terms of wages, said Richard Wobekind, an associate dean and a senior economist at Leeds. The strongest job gains next year are forecast to come in professional and business services, where positions are mostly on the upper end of the pay scale. Education and healthcare should contribute to employment growth, and governments are expected to keep hiring, aided on the local level by higher property taxes. Higher interest rates, however, will remain a major headwind for the economy and are expected to contribute to job losses in construction, finance, and real estate. Manufacturing and information, which includes tech, are also forecast to see declines. Wobekind isn't in the camp of economists expecting a sharp drop in interest rates next year, saying they will stay elevated for longer than expected. Homebuyers holding out for a 5% rate on a 30-year mortgage should be looking for things to stay closer to 6%. A huge reckoning continues in commercial real estate, and while it is playing out slowly, loans made now under unrealistic assumptions will have to be reworked. Banks continue to tighten their lending standards as they try to build up their reserves against losses, and venture capital remains scarce. Yet the economy can continue to move forward as long as consumers hold in there, which they have shown a willingness to do. Our committee members are expressing optimism in a slow environment, Wobekind said. We will be resilient. We will continue to have growth. But Wobekind also concedes the outlook, which calls for U.S. GDP to gain 1.4% next year, is among the more optimistic ones out there. On Monday, the National Association for Business Economics forecasted that U.S. economic growth would slow to 1% by the fourth quarter of next year. About 3 out of 4 of its economists surveyed put the odds of a recession next year at 50% or lower, which was an improvement from the sentiment in the October survey, but still not a ringing endorsement. Marcel Arsenault, CEO of Real Capital Solutions, offered a more dire view of what is coming, shaped in part of his understanding on what is going on in commercial real estate, which was the focus of a keynote panel that followed the outlook forecast. In our shop, we are worried about a recession, Arsenault told the crowd gathered at the Grand Hyatt Denver. He predicted Colorado would likely lose jobs next year and that the vacancy rate for apartments, which are being overbuilt, could reach 15% next year, or triple the current rate. Consumer spending, which accounts for about 70% of economic activity, will be key in determining how quickly the economy slows next year and whether it tips into a recession. And inflation, both real and perceived, could influence the willingness of consumers to spend. The outlook calls for consumer inflation in the Denver area to average 3.2% next year, which is below the 5.4% annual rate measured in September. But views diverge on how quickly inflation can get below the 2% level the Federal Reserve is targeting, which would allow it to start lowering interest rates. Inflation in Metro Denver has run substantially hotter than in the country as a whole, driven by larger jumps in rent and other housing-related costs, which account for more than 40% of the weighting in the Consumer Price Index. More volatile gasoline prices in the region are also causing consumers in the region to fork over more money. Ron Thraup, an associate professor of real estate at the University of Denver's Daniels College of Business, said the way the federal government calculates housing inflation contributes to a long lag that distorts the overall inflation number. Shelter in inflation, as reported in the CPI for Denver, was running 8.4% in September. But other rent indices were capturing much smaller increases this fall. Apartment lists, for example, has Denver apartment rents down nearly 1% over the past year through November. Eventually, those declines will make their way into the official CPI numbers, Thraup said, causing them to show sharp decreases. "We are going lower as far as I can tell," he said, even raising the possibility that deflation could emerge. He expects the Federal Reserve could start cutting interest rates next summer, sooner than what many economists expect. Two other economists speaking on the same panel as Throup on Monday argued for more persistent inflation going forward. "Let's get to 2% before we start talking about deflation," said Gedney, who noted that an aging population and tight labor market are likely to keep upward pressure on wages well into the future. Even before the recent surge of inflation coming out of the pandemic, labor shortages were causing wages in Colorado and elsewhere to surge above the long-term trend, Gedney said. He estimates that the average weekly wages in Colorado in 2022 were about 20% higher than would have been the case if they had followed the trend that existed between 2000 to 2016. "Wage gains have mostly kept up with inflation, but so far this year workers are behind by 1.7% in real terms, in part because of the higher inflation rate in the region. Above 2% in 2024 and probably again in 2025, said Emily Dorman, an economist with the Colorado Legislative Council, adding that a negative rate would likely require a big downturn in the economy. Arsenault argued people should prepare for the scenario the outlook calls for, slower growth with no recession, while also being ready for the possibility of a more severe downturn. Purdue Pharma at U.S. Supreme Court. Justices seem split over opioid settlement. By Abby Van Sickle, The New York Times, Washington. Supreme Court justices seemed divided Monday over a fiercely contested bankruptcy settlement for Purdue Pharma that would funnel billions of dollars to address the opioid epidemic in exchange for shielding members of the wealthy Sackler family from related lawsuits. The U.S. Trustee Program, an office in the Justice Department, had challenged the deal, saying it violated federal law by guaranteeing such wide-ranging legal immunity for the Sacklers, even as they had not declared bankruptcy. Questions from the justices reflected why the agreement, which pits money against principle, has drawn intense scrutiny to start. Under debate was the practical effect of unraveling the settlement, painstakingly negotiated for years, and broader concerns over whether releasing the Sacklers from liability should be allowed. The opioid victims and their families overwhelmingly approve this plan because they think it will ensure prompt payment, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said. He asked why the government was pushing to end a tactic known as third-party non-consensual releases, which has figured in settlements approved over 30 years of bankruptcy court practice. The lawyer for the government, Curtis Gannon, acknowledged the tension, but he argued that the U.S. trustee has been given this watchdog role and that a ruling for the government would not foreclose an opioid deal with the Sacklers. Although the question before the court was a narrow one, whether the bankruptcy code allowed such non-consensual third-party waivers, the deal's effect on a public health crisis that has left tens of thousands of people dead was on full display. While Kavanaugh and others repeatedly questioned what any ruling would mean for victims of the opioid crisis and their families, others asked what consequences would be for other settlements, including sexual abuse lawsuits against the Boy Scouts of America and the Catholic Church, that have included this release of liability. Justice Amy Coney Barrett raised what a victory for the U.S. trustee would mean for other victims of mass torts. Gannon responded that Congress could pass legislation that specified how such deals could work. It was not the government's role, he said, to speak for victims, but rather to be concerned about the entire process. Inside the crowded courtroom, the justices appeared deeply engaged in the case, leaning forward periodically during 2 hours of argument. Their questions did not appear to line up along ideological lines, signaling the decision could be a close one. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson seemed skeptical of claims that third-party non-consensual releases were the only way to solve the thorny problem of compensating opioid victims. She asked a lawyer for victims groups Pratik A. Shah why the agreement needed to be reached through bankruptcy court. Shah insisted that the releases were critical to the deal. Without it, members of the Sackler family would not sign on to an agreement, he said, which risks leaving victims with nothing. Without the release, the plan will unravel, he said. There will be no viable path to any victim recovery. Well, that sounded very emphatic, Justice Elena Kagan replied, to laughter. Kagan appeared to be puzzling through her views from the bench. She seemed skeptical of the U.S. trustee's position and asked whether the government was standing in the way of an agreement that had the overwhelming approval of victims, people who are among those who think that the Sacklers are pretty much the worst people on earth. But she later pointedly asked the lawyer for Purdue Pharma, Gregory C. Gare, whether such deals subverted the bankruptcy process by allowing wealthy people to shield themselves from lawsuits, including claims of fraud, without putting anything near their entire pot of assets on the table. In some ways, they're getting a better deal than the usual bankruptcy discharge, Kagan said, because they're being protected from claims of fraud and claims of willful misconduct. Jackson seemed to share those concerns. She pointed to frustrations voiced by the original bankruptcy judge that the Sacklers had moved money out of Purdue into offshore accounts. The Sacklers took the assets from the company, which started the set of circumstances in which the company now doesn't have enough money to pay the creditors, she said. Outside the courtroom, dozens of demonstrators called on the justices to overturn the bankruptcy deal, saying that they believed it did little for families of victims and failed to hold the Sacklers to account. Many wore red T-shirts that read, "Sackler v. the People," under an image of the Supreme Court, and brandished signs with photos of family members who had died from drug overdoses. A decision could come as late as June, near the end of the court's term. In recent years, bankruptcy court has become a popular place to deal with mass injury settlements. The Purdue case and others like it rely on a system that courts in some parts of the country say allows third parties, such as the Sacklers, to be freed from liability, even though they themselves are not declaring bankruptcy. War with Hamas. Israel attacks southern Gaza. More evacuations are ordered, but Palestinians run out of places to go. By Najib Jubain, Sami Magdi, and Jack Jeffrey, The Associated Press, Khan Yunus, Gaza Strip. Israeli warplanes heavily bombard an area around Khan Yunus in southern Gaza on Monday as the military ordered mass evacuations from the town in the face of a widening ground offensive that is pushing Palestinians into a progressively shrinking portion of the besieged territory. The expanded assault posed a deadly choice for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians: either stay in the path of Israeli forces or flee within the confines of southern Gaza with no guarantee of safety. Aid workers warned that the mass movement would worsen the already dire humanitarian catastrophe in the territory. Another wave of displacement is underway, and the humanitarian situation worsens by the hour, the Gaza chief of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Thomas White, said in a post on X. Adding to the chaos, phone and internet networks across Gaza collapsed again Monday evening, the Palestinian telecom provider Peltel reported. The network has broken down multiple times during the war, making it largely impossible for residents to communicate with each other or the outside world for hours or sometimes several days until it is repaired. Israel has vowed to eliminate Gaza's Hamas rulers, whose October 7th attack into Israel killed some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and triggered the deadliest Israeli-Palestinian violence in decades. The war has already killed thousands of Palestinians and displaced over three-fourths of the territory's population of 2.3 million people. Palestinian health officials say bombardment has killed several hundred civilians since a week-long truce ended Friday. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the U.S., Canada, and the European Union. Already under mounting pressure from its top ally, the United States, Israel appears to be racing to strike a death blow against Hamas, if that's possible, given the group's deep roots in Palestinian society, before any new ceasefire. But the mounting toll is likely to further increase international pressure to return to the negotiating table. Airstrikes and the ground offensive in northern Gaza have reduced large swaths of Gaza City and nearby areas to a rubble-filled wasteland. Hundreds of thousands of residents fled south during the assault. Around 2 million people, most of the territory's population, are crowded into the 90 square miles of southern and central Gaza, where Israel's ground offensive is now moving, threatening to render even larger areas uninhabitable. Since the truce's collapse, the military has ordered the population out of an area of about 24 square miles in and near Khan Yunis, according to the evacuation maps issued by the Israeli military. That further reduces the space available for Palestinians by more than a quarter. Constant bombardment on the edges of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, lit up the sky over the town Monday evening, and a stream of ambulances carrying wounded, including several women and children, flowed into the main hospital. Over the past few days, Israeli strikes have been on a ferocious scale, said Mohammed Agha Kurdi, an aid worker with the group Medical Aid for Palestinians in Khan Yunis. Barely has any kind of aid been delivered to the people, nor is there any food left in shops. He said neighborhoods and displaced shelters were emptying as people fled. Leaflets dropped by the military warn people to go south toward the border with Egypt, but they are unable to leave Gaza, as both Israel and neighboring Egypt have refused to accept any refugees. The area that Israel ordered evacuated covers about a fifth of Khan Yunis. Before the war, that area was home to some 117,000 people, and now it also houses more than 50,000 people displaced from the north, living in 21 shelters, the UN said. It was not known how many were fleeing. Some Palestinians have ignored past evacuation orders, saying they do not feel any safer since areas where they are told to flee have also been bombed. Many also fear they will never be allowed back to their homes. It was not clear where Israeli troops have moved into southern Gaza, but the military told people to stay off the main road between Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah, suggesting forces were moving between the two towns. Israeli media also reported intense fighting between Israeli troops and Hamas in northern Gaza, in the Jabalia refugee camp and the Gaza City district of Shijaya, both scenes of intense bombardment and battles in recent weeks. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, the Israeli military spokesman, said the army is pursuing Hamas with maximum force in the north and south while trying to minimize harm to civilians. He pointed to a map that divides southern Gaza into dozens of blocks in order to give precise instructions to residents on where to evacuate. Most are urged to flee south, but confusingly, a map posted on X by the military Monday urged people to flee into Fakari, a district east of Khan Yunis that the military ordered evacuated a day before. The level of human suffering is intolerable, Mirjana Spoljaric, the president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, said during a rare visit to Gaza. It is unacceptable that civilians have no safe place to go in Gaza, and with the military siege in place, there is also no adequate humanitarian response currently possible. The World Health Organization said it was told by Israel to empty its medical supplies warehouse in southern Gaza within 24 hours ahead of an advancing ground operation. The agency appealed to Israel to withdraw the order. Spoljaric, the Red Cross president, called for the immediate release of scores of hostages still held by Hamas since the October 7th attack. In a letter to the Red Cross chief, a group of released Israeli hostages asked to meet with her while she is visiting the region and called for more help from the organization to free the remaining 137 captives. Letter to Congress. White House warns aid for Ukraine is running out, by Karun Demirjian and Laura Jakes, The New York Times, Washington. The White House warned congressional leaders Monday that the United States would run out of money to send weapons to Ukraine by year's end, severely jeopardizing Ukraine's ability to defend itself against a Russian invasion if lawmakers fail to approve emergency military aid soon. The urgent warning from President Joe Biden's top budget official, delivered in a blunt letter, was the administration's latest bid to pressure the Republicans resisting another infusion of aid to Ukraine to drop their opposition. It came at a critical time in the war, as Ukraine struggles to push back Russian troops in a counteroffensive that has largely stalled. Russian President Vladimir Putin has continued to send a steady stream of his forces into the conflict, willing to endure high casualties amid signs of flagging resolve from Ukraine's Western allies. "We are out of money and nearly out of time," Shalonda Young, the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, wrote in the letter, which was sent to House and Senate leaders in both parties. "Cutting off the flow of U.S. weapons and equipment will kneecap Ukraine on the battlefield, not only putting at risk the gains Ukraine has made, but increasing the likelihood of Russian military victories," she continued, adding, "This isn't a next year problem. The time to help a democratic Ukraine fight against Russian aggression is right now." On Capitol Hill, Republican backing for Ukraine's war effort has dwindled substantially in recent months. The party's leaders have said they will consider additional aid only in exchange for one of their top policy priorities, major changes to border policy to severely limit the number of migrants entering the United States. And on Monday, the White House plea fell on deaf ears in the House, where Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said Democrats have not done enough to earn the support of his members to send more money to Ukraine. "The Biden administration has failed to substantively address any of my conference's legitimate concerns about the lack of clear strategy in Ukraine, a path to resolving the conflict, or a plan for adequately ensuring accountability for aid provided by American taxpayers," Johnson said on X, formerly known as Twitter, on Monday, responding to the White House letter. House Republicans have resolved that any national security supplemental package must begin with our own border. In recent weeks, the GOP's ultimatum and Ukraine's vanishing funds prompted a group of Senate Democrats and Republicans to try to hash out a deal on border policies. But the talks have faltered as lawmakers proved unable to resolve a series of impasses over some of the GOP's most draconian border demands. The issue is coming to a head this week as the Democratic-led Senate prepares to vote on more than $61 billion in Ukraine-focused assistance as part of a $106 billion national security package that would also fund Israel's war effort in the Gaza Strip. The bill needs Republican votes to move forward, but the stalemate has left Democrats and the White House with no option to secure them other than pressuring GOP lawmakers who have supported Ukraine in the past to abandon their party's border security demands, forecasting dire consequences if they do not. "Any member of Congress who does not support funding for Ukraine is voting for an outcome that will make it easier for Putin to prevail," Jack Sullivan, the White House National Security Advisor, told reporters Monday. "A vote against supplemental funding for Ukraine will hurt Ukraine and help Russia. It will hurt democracy and help dictators. And we think that it is not the right lesson of history and that every member, Democrat and Republican, should vote to support this." Further complicating the White House's warning is an ongoing dispute within the Biden administration over just how urgently Ukraine needs additional aid. Pentagon officials said they were surprised by the claim that the United States is out of funds, since they are still doling out more than $100 million worth of arms and ammunition from stockpiles every week or so. They said they anticipate being able to stretch out shipments to make the remaining $4.8 billion last through the winter, when the pace of fighting is expected to decline. Defense Department officials also expect that billions of dollars of new weapons and equipment purchased directly from manufacturers will be delivered to Ukraine over the coming months. Since Russia attacked Ukraine in early 2022, Congress has poured $111 billion into Ukraine's war effort, including security and humanitarian assistance. Some GOP leaders, such as Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, the minority leader, have enthusiastically supported such aid, arguing that the investments are not only a moral necessity, but also economically advantageous to the United States, as most of the weapons sent to Ukraine are produced domestically. But as the battle grinds on and the U.S. presidential election looms, Republicans increasingly have raised skepticism about providing Ukraine with financial support and have sought to use the war as a political cudgel against the Biden administration. Republicans twice refused to include Ukraine war funding in stopgap spending bills to keep the government funded this fall, arguing that the issue would have to be tied to border security. Their demands prompted the Biden administration to ask lawmakers for almost $14 billion to hire additional border patrol and asylum officers and build detention facilities as part of the president's $106 billion national security supplemental request. Financial investments were not enough to satisfy Republicans, however. While Democrats have been willing to negotiate changes to asylum laws, such as raising the standard for migrants claiming a credible fear of prosecution in their home countries, they were unable to swallow codifying more stringent detention policies, such as one that would keep migrants out of the United States while waiting for their day in immigration court. Johnson, who has voted repeatedly against aid for Ukraine, has told GOP senators in recent days that House Republicans would not support more funding for Ukraine unless it was attached to legislation passed by his chamber to revive strict Trump-era administration policies. "I will not vote for any aid until we secure our border," Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, said Sunday on CNN's State of the Union. He added, "I'm not helping Ukraine until we help ourselves." As the fate of Ukraine aid remains in limbo, allies have openly worried about whether the United States will sustain the support of the nearly two-year war and what that will mean on the battlefield. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine has long made clear how big a loss it would be to his war effort should American military assistance end. Zelensky will address U.S. senators by video Tuesday during a classified briefing amid the request for funds, the AP reported. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg met in Brussels on Monday with Rustam Umerov, Ukraine's defense minister, to reiterate the military alliance's long-term support, according to a NATO statement. But a day earlier, in an interview with the German broadcaster ARD, Stoltenberg said that though countries ought to support Ukraine through good times and bad, we should also be prepared for bad news. In battlefield interviews, Ukrainian soldiers said the amount of American weapons and other equipment had already begun to drop. In one frontline artillery unit more than 150 miles north of Avdiivka in eastern Ukraine, soldiers had only 20 shells per day allotted to them, which meant they could realistically hope to take out two targets. When the same unit was in Kherson during the offensive last summer, they had five times as much ammunition at their disposal, the soldiers said. Charged with spying for Cuba, former U.S. diplomat engaged in clandestine activity for decades by Joshua Goodman and Eric Tucker, the Associated Press, Miami. A former career American diplomat was charged Monday with serving as a secret agent for communist Cuba going back decades in what prosecutors portrayed as one of the most brazen and long-running betrayals in the history of the U.S. Foreign Service. Manuel Rocha wept as he sat handcuffed in Miami federal court on charges that he engaged in clandestine activity on Cuba's behalf since at least 1981, the year he joined the U.S. Foreign Service, including by meeting with Cuban intelligence operatives and providing false information to U.S. government officials about his contacts. The complaint is short on specifics of how Rocha may have assisted Cuba, but it provides a vivid case study of what American officials say are longstanding efforts by Cuba and its notoriously sophisticated intelligence services to target U.S. government officials who can be flipped. This action exposes one of the highest-reaching and longest-lasting infiltrations of the United States government by a foreign agent, Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a statement. To betray that trust by falsely pledging loyalty to the United States while serving a foreign power is a crime that will be met with the full force of the Justice Department. The 73-year-old Rocha, whose two-decade career as a U.S. diplomat included top spots in Bolivia, Argentina, and the U.S. interest section in Havana, was arrested by the FBI at his Miami home Friday. He was ordered held following Monday's brief court appearance, pending a bond hearing Wednesday. His attorney declined to comment. The Justice Department did not reveal how Rocha attracted the attention of Cuba's intelligence operatives, nor did it describe what, if any, sensitive information he may have provided while working for the State Department and in a lucrative post-government career that included a stint as a special advisor to the commander of U.S. Southern Command. Instead, the case relies largely on what prosecutors say were Rocha's own admissions made over the past year to an undercover FBI agent posing as a Cuban intelligence operative named Miguel. Rocha praised the late Cuban leader Fidel Castro as comandante, branded the U.S. as the enemy, and bragged about his service for more than 40 years as a Cuban mole in the heart of U.S. foreign policy circles, the complaint says. What we have done, it's enormous, more than a grand slam, he was quoted as saying at one of the several secretly recorded conversations. To cover his tracks, Rocha referred to Cuba as the island and led a normal life disguised as a right-wing person, he said in one of the recordings. Former colleagues and friends describe Rocha as a vocal admirer of former President Donald Trump, who took a hard line on Cuba. John Feely, who ended a long diplomatic career serving the U.S. ambassador to Panama, said he was surprised how his mentor, who had served administrations of both parties, had so fully embraced Trump's politics. It is beyond ironic that he cultivated this cartoonish persona, he said, and that everyone apparently bought it. Arriving from Texas, busload of migrants gets dropped off at state capitol by Seth Klaman, The Denver Post. A busload of migrants was dropped off outside the Colorado Capitol building in Denver on Monday morning in what a city official believes is the latest in a wave of buses chartered by the Texas state government. It's unclear how many people were on the bus. Senator Julie Gonzalez, a Denver Democrat who was at the Capitol as the bus was unloading about 8:30 a.m., estimated the number of people on board at 40 to 50. She directed them into the building to get warm while officials coordinated the next steps. Gonzalez said some of the migrants told her they'd come from Eagle Pass, a Texas town near the border with Mexico. Evan Dreyer, a deputy chief of staff to Denver Mayor Mike Johnston, said he hadn't received confirmation about the circumstances of the bus trip, but that it matched a recent pattern of buses arriving from the border state. The state of Texas, the governor's office, has contracted with two or three different bus companies to transport migrants out of Texas to various locations around the country, Denver being one of those locations, Dreyer said. That's our understanding, and that's how this has operated for several months. Denver has received more than 200 charter buses direct from Texas over the last 6 months. Spokespersons for Texas Governor Greg Abbott did not return requests for comment Monday. Gonzalez said the migrants she spoke to told her they were from Venezuela. More than 29,000 migrants, primarily from Venezuela, have arrived in Denver since December 2022. After groups of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border began overwhelming Texas cities. Many of the migrants have fled widespread violence and economic instability in the South American country, often traveling through Central America on foot. Dreyer said city officials repeatedly have requested that arriving buses take migrants to Union Station or a city intake center, but those requests have been ignored. Migrants have been dropped off near city and county buildings, though Dryer City believed Monday was the first time people have been left at the state capitol. The migrants were later directed to the Wellington E. Webb Municipal Office a few blocks away, Dryer said. Gonzalez praised city officials for their work in helping migrants in recent months. But Dryer criticized the decision to drop the migrants in Denver without coordination or cold weather clothing. Temperatures in Denver were in the low to mid-40s Monday morning. These are folks who have come from the Texas border after long journeys, and they are not prepared for cold weather, he said. And to drop them off like that, just randomly, in the cold, in the freezing cold, is inhumane, dangerous, and it puts their lives at risk. It's shameful. Pregnancy and breastfeeding. Frontier settles discrimination lawsuit with pilots. By Katie Langford, The Denver Post. Frontier Airlines will settle a federal lawsuit filed by five pilots who accused the Denver-based airline of discriminating against them during pregnancy and while breastfeeding. Through the settlement, Frontier will allow pilots to pump breast milk in the cockpit during non-critical phases of a flight and will update or comply with existing policies that impact pregnant and lactating employees. It is one of the first airlines to allow pilots to pump during flights, according to a Monday news release from the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Colorado, Denver-based legal nonprofit Towards Justice, and the firm Howell, Schuster, and Goldberg. Settling the lawsuit filed in December 2019 does not admit any liability by Frontier, according to the news release. In a statement, ACLU Center for Liberty staff attorney Aditi Frutwala said the organization is proud to come to an agreement that will benefit pregnant and lactating workers now and in the future. This settlement should serve as a strong message to employers, especially airline employers, that reasonable accommodations such as those agreed to by Frontier are good for workers, good for families, good for business, and required by the law, Frutwala said. We're hopeful this will inspire more change and stronger protections for workers across the airline industry. Two lawsuits filed by Colorado-based pilots and flight attendants in December 2019 allege the airline's policies and practices were discriminatory, including forbidding women from pumping while in uniform and disciplining them for seeking breastfeeding-related accommodations. All of the women flew out of Denver International Airport. The lawsuits also allege that Frontier forced employees onto unpaid leave during their pregnancies and did not allow them to seek accommodations that could have kept them on the job. According to the news release, Frontier Airlines has agreed to comply with an existing union agreement that allows pregnant pilots to fly with medical certification, clarify that pilots who cannot fly due to pregnancy or lactation will be accommodated on the same terms as pilots with other medical conditions that prevent them from flying, continue to allow pilots who are breastfeeding to drop to 50 hours of flight time per month, and maintain a list of airport lactation facilities that is published on an internal website and updated every 6 months. The lawsuit filed by the flight attendants was settled in April 2022 under similar terms, according to the ACLU. In a statement, Frontier's Vice President of Labor Relations, Jacqueline Peter, said the company is proud to be at the forefront of accommodating the needs of pregnant and breastfeeding mothers in the airline industry. Thanks in part to advances in wearable lactation technology, the parties were able to reach an amicable resolution of this case that also maintains our commitment to the highest safety standards, Peter said. Representatives for Frontier Airlines, the ACLU, and the ACLU of Colorado declined to comment on the settlement beyond statements included in the news release. A copy of this settlement was not immediately available Monday evening. Legislation from Caraveo, Measure to Tackle Animal Tranquilizer Abuse Passes. Bipartisan Tranq measure now heads to President Biden's desk for his signature. By John Aguilar, The Denver Post. A bill spearheaded by U.S. Representative Yadira Caraveo to combat the rising drug scourge of xylazine a powerful animal tranquilizer that users mix with fentanyl and other substances, passed the House on Monday and now heads to President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Xylazine, also known by its street names Trank and Zombie Drug, for the severe rotting wounds it can cause in humans, spurred a warning from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration last spring about its potential lethality, especially when mixed with opioids such as fentanyl. The drug is not approved for human use. The bipartisan bill, dubbed the Testing, Rapid Analysis, and Narcotic Quality Trank Research Act, directs the National Institute of Standards and Technology to focus its research on existing and emerging illicit drugs containing xylazine and other emerging substances. NIST researchers have been helping to improve and develop technologies to get ahead of synthetic drugs. And Caraveo's bill directs the agency to apply those efforts to xylazine as well. The bill was the freshman congresswoman's first to pass through both chambers of Congress. Introduced in March, it was approved by the Senate in June and came back to the House with minor changes for Monday's vote. Last year, 1,799 Coloradans died of a drug overdose, down slightly from the 1,881 overdose deaths recorded in the state the year before. Fentanyl and methamphetamine continue to push the state's per capita overdose rate to alarming levels. New illicit drugs like Trank are fueling an epidemic that is devastating American communities, including families here in Colorado, Caraveo said in a statement issued shortly after the House gave final passage to her bill on a voice vote. We need to head off these alarming new threats before they spread. Caraveo took office in January, becoming the first representative of Colorado's newly formed 8th Congressional District, which covers parts of Adams, Weld, and Larimer counties. Colorado Bureau of Investigation. Search continues in killing of 17-year-old Maggie Long. Officials still offering $75,000 reward for information in the case. By Michael Braithwaite, The Denver Post. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation said that it is continuing to investigate the December 2017 death of Park County High School senior Maggie Long, noting a $75,000 reward for information critical to the case, according to a release. The announcement comes 6 years to the day after Long, 17, was found murdered in her burned-down home after an apparent burglary, according to the cold case report. She was coming home to gather supplies for a concert at the school she was helping organize. Our quest for justice for Maggie remains steadfast, said Park County Sheriff Tom McGraw in the release. The dedicated members of the Maggie Long Task Force, including the Park County Sheriff's Office, the 11th Judicial District Attorney's Office, and our state and federal partners, have never stopped the search for those responsible for Maggie's death and will continue to follow every lead until we find resolution in this case. Several items, including guns, jade figurines, and a safe, were stolen from the home at the time of Long's death, and the house was set on fire, authorities said. Police say they have reason to believe that more than one person may have been involved in her death. The Bureau would like anyone with information on the crime to call the Maggie Long Task Force tip line at 303-239-4243. Or to email maggie.long.tips@state.co.us. Those providing tips can remain anonymous. It will take one person with one piece of information that will help our investigative team bring resolution to this case for Maggie, her family, and the Bailey community, McGraw said. City Council. A Denver Fair Elections Fund rounding error is corrected. Public Campaign Financing Program Will Grow Just at Rate of Inflation, by Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. The Denver City Council on Monday unanimously approved a handful of tweaks to the voter-approved Fair Elections Fund, including a change that will save the city an estimated $4.4 million over 4 years. That doesn't mean there will be less to go around when candidates next line up to run for city council, mayor, and other municipal offices in 2027, and possibly qualify for public financing to fuel their campaigns. Before Monday, the city's annual financial obligation to the Fair Elections Fund was poised to ratchet up almost 75% next year to $5 per resident. Now, the city's annual contribution to the fund is expected to rise from $2.88 per Denverite per year to $3.45 in 2025, corresponding with the rate of inflation in the Denver-Aurora-Lakewood metro area. It will be adjusted again in 2029. That increase should funnel around $400,000 more into the pot each year than the current annual contribution of $2.1 million, according to the Denver Clerk and Recorder's Office. That will grow the fund beyond its existing $8 million cap, but stay within the realm of what voters intended when they approved the program more than 5 years ago, election officials say. Monday's change was a result of literally a rounding error in the bill language, Deputy Clerk and Recorder Audrey Klein told the Council's Finance and Governance Committee last month. The code as written called for the city's annual contributions to rise with inflation but be rounded to the lowest $5. That would have meant hiking the annual transfer to $3.6 million as early as next year. Council changed to rounded to the nearest lowest 1 cent. Monday's changes also ensure that all contribution limits will rise with inflation and clarified financial filing deadlines in the years leading up to an election. Fair Elections Fund candidates accept lower contribution limits, $500 compared to $1,000 for mayor, $350 versus $700 for at-large council seats, and $200 versus $400 for district council seats in this cycle, in return for public matches on donations between $5 and $50. The program's 9-to-1 match ratio turns a $50 donation into $500 with taxpayer money. The fund doled out just shy of $7.7 million to 47 candidates in the city's 2023 election, the first cycle since the program was approved by voters in 2018. Mayor Mike Johnston and every sitting council member except for Amanda Sawyer received payments. The clerk's office is considering more substantive changes to the program, but expects those discussions to take place next year. Denver. Hundreds of protesters shut down Spear Boulevard by Lauren Pennington, the Denver Post. Hundreds of protesters with Jewish Voice for Peace, who are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, shut down Spear Boulevard on Sunday outside the Colorado Convention Center, which was hosting the Global Conference for Israel. More than 200 members of the activist organization marched from the Tivoli Quad on Auraria campus to the intersection of Spear Boulevard and Champa Street around 11:30 a.m. Sunday, calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, humanitarian aid, and an end to U.S. aid to Israel, according to a Sunday news release from Jewish Voice for Peace. The rally came just after the end of the one-week ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and nearly 2 months after the conflict first started, with Hamas militants attacking several areas in Israel, killing over 1,200 people and taking hundreds of hostages, according to Israeli officials. As of Sunday, more than 15,500 people had been confirmed killed in Gaza since the start of the conflict, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ministry told AP reporters that 70% of those killed are women and children. As Jews, we wholeheartedly reject violence against the Palestinian people in the name of Jewish safety, said Ellie Cannington, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, in the news release. The group parked a car at the intersection, and a small group of activists chained themselves to each other and to the parked vehicle with duct tape, tubes, and metal wire, blocking traffic. Police diverted traffic away from the intersection for more than an hour before 15 people were arrested by Denver officers, according to the Denver Police Department. All 15 had been released by Sunday evening, according to a news release from Jewish Voice for Peace. A spokesperson for the police department wrote in an emailed statement that officers made three separate announcements over a public address system for the people to leave the roadway or face arrest. When they refused to move, officers started arresting individuals around 12:40 p.m. Denver Fire Department personnel used power tools to safely separate the individuals from each other and the vehicle so they could be arrested, according to the police department statement. Several protesters in the activist organization's news release claimed this action unnecessarily endangered the demonstrators and that the emergency responders should have used manual tools instead of electric saws. A total of 15 people were arrested in connection with obstructing a street, failure to obey a police order, and using prohibited equipment to obstruct the public's and emergency crews' ability to use the roadway, the police department said in its statement. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.